Testing, testing. This is Dave Crippen at the archives of the Henry Ford Museum. We are continuing our series of interviews with key automotive designers. And today we have with us Mr. David C. Dave Turner, Jr., who is a 25-year veteran in Ford styling and design. And we're going to ask Mr. Turner to tell his story in his own way.
Well, you have to prompt me with questions here. I'm not sure exactly what kind of information you're after, so to ask me some questions and let me... I'm a native Detroiter, and my interest in car design, probably the car business, let's say, comes from living here, number one. My father worked for the Bethlehem Steel Company, and he sold steel, or was the manager, district manager for Bethlehem Steel Company around here, sold steel to the automobile companies, and so therefore I have, my family has something of a connection, so I've always liked the automobile business, I've always liked automobiles, and the two of them went together to send me off to college, not to design cars, but to become an engineer, because I thought that's what you did when you wanted to design cars, or when you wanted to get into it when you were an engineer. I found that my own particular interests are not in the engineering field. Mathematics is not... Well, I can stand mathematics. It's not my favorite thing to spend some time at. So I then found myself drifting, not exactly liking engineering, and not doing that well either. My grades probably, they were okay. I could have gotten by, but I was not going to be an outstanding engineer. So that led me to automobile design, which seemed to put together everything I had. At the same time, I also had an ability to draw and paint and render and some artistic abilities. They seemed to go together perfectly in car design.
You did get an
industrial
design degree.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I switched majors while I was in college from engineering and industrial design. Only because my upbringing, I guess, was in the car industry, and I always liked cars literally better than any other product there was out there, so that led me to car design. So basically, I'm a car fan. Yes, they did. They were attempting to put together a car design school at that time. Mr. Exner, Verge Exner, had a son who went there. And I think Verge Exner Sr. liked Notre Dame just because it's the, you know, the Catholic institution, and he then wanted his kid to take car design, so they tried to bend the industrial design department over to car design, and for several years they did. They've since abandoned car design as a primary focus of the industrial design department. They still have industrial design, but they're not trying to turn out car designers. So at that time they were trying, so they were teaching car design there.
So you were...
No, I wasn't drafted. When I graduated from Notre Dame in 1961, I came straight to work here at Ford Motor Company. And
you'd had some interim experience at Smith Interim.
Yeah, that was just a summer job as a drafting job. Yeah, no, not significant. No.
So in 62, you were enlisted in the Navy?
No, I came here to work for Ford, and the draft was after me at that time. I don't know if you recall that era. It was not the era where you could not avoid, I mean, you had to do something about the draft. You either were drafted, went to a reserve program, or went into the service voluntarily. So the draft was after me in the sense that I was going to be drafted shortly. And so I decided to, I've always been interested in airplanes and all kinds of things like that, so I decided to volunteer for the U.S. Navy flight training program. So I'm a graduate of the Navy. Naval flight officers. I'm not a pilot, a designated pilot. I'm a naval flight officer, which is a officer crew member similar to, I was a bombardier navigator, but similar to this fellow. This fellow was shot down here in Iran not long ago, was a naval flight officer. He was in the right seat of that A-6 intruder that was shot down. So I spent 5 years in the Navy as a naval flight officer. Enjoyed every minute of it. Served in the squadron I was assigned to Roosevelt Roads, Puerto Rico. So I lived there, but we were deployed various places around the world, mostly in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean.
What type of
One Lockheed SP2H, P2V Neptunes. I don't know if you're familiar with those or not. Twin engine, two recips, two jets, and an anti-submarine warfare aircraft. Yes, it is, electronically. It was at that time, anyway. Now it's pilot junk, but...
And you enjoyed your tour of duty? You were there 5 years?
Well, you had when you went into the flight school, and you accepted the training and accepted the 18 months of training, when you got out of training, you had to serve 3.5 months after you graduated from training, so the net was 5 years for me. But no, I enjoyed every minute of it. I enjoy every minute. I didn't want to stay. I mean, I complained like everybody, but looking back on it, I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Where were you stationed, you said, for
example? Well, we were deployed to Iceland and to Spain and to South America and various places around the world, but I never lived in any of those places. We stayed there for a short period of time.
Were you married at this time?
Mm-hmm.
Did your wife accompany you on some of these?
She lived in Puerto Rico.
Did she?
And that was her home. This was only eight.
So obviously, you went back to your first love.
Yes, I did. At the time I was in the Navy in Puerto Rico, I was debating, at that time, I left Ford Motor Company with a leave of absence, but in the back of my mind, I wasn't sure if I was ever coming back, because at that time, flying looked pretty good to me, and that may be a good way to spend the rest of my life. So, I debated, maybe the last couple of years in the Navy, whether to come back or not, and I decided that that's what I wanted to do, was to get out of the Navy and come back, so I wrote them a letter and asked them if I could come back, and they said, your leave of absence is still in effect, so they took me back. Simple as that.
Pretty much what you've been doing.
Yeah, basically took up where I left off. You lose 5 years out of your career for whatever it's worth, but I still wouldn't trade it.
And what was basically?
I've got to look at this thing to remember, refresh my memory. This has been a long time. I worked for on the Ford College Graduate Training Program when I came back to Ford, basically as a college graduate trainee for 2 years. Let's see, where did I work? It looked like I worked in a lot of studios that time. The program consisted of a 5 to 6 month assignment in different studios for a period of 2 years, and basically my first 2 years is just that. I don't remember a great deal about it other than the fact that I was very much in the learning stage. I was rusty at that time. I spent 5 years not even thinking about that.
Not even doing
anything wrong at all. No, I'm too busy. I mean, you're in the U.S. Navy as an officer. You've got all you can handle. So I didn't do that. So I basically spent 2 years probably retraining myself is what I did.
What does FCGP?
Ford College Graduate. At that time, they called it Ford College Graduate Training Program, and it was a very structured kind of a program the whole company had. Do you recall that era, or you don't work for Ford, do you?
No.
Okay. Had a very structured Ford College Graduate Program at that time, company-wide. I'm not sure how much I remember about that, other than the fact that the design center seemed not to participate as fully as the rest of the company did. I would be assigned to go to the various tours through the plants that they had. They had organized tours through the plants for the graduates. They had sessions over at World Headquarters. It seemed to me it was once or twice a month, where in the evening you had to go over and listen to a lecture about some facet of the company. And if I remember correctly, you had to sign in there, but you weren't paid for it. People used to go in and sign in and then skip out before the lecture. But that wasn't in fact, and when I came back, the second time, there was no such structured program. The design center just transferred you every 6 months. That was the program. Mm-hmm.
So you were pretty much started out as a designer.
You mean when I first came back from the service? Yes, but I was a, what do they call me there? They call me designer various studios. No, I was the trainee designate. I was the salary grade 6, which at that time was called designer A, I think. You heard that term before? Designer A, which was at that time was the lowest, I believe, pay grade for designers. So during that period of time, I was just assigned to various studios where I would work mostly doing sketches and basically doing not particularly important jobs in the studio. You're not really deep into the design at that point in time. You're basically a trainee.
But you're doing something
Yes, it was, but I never stayed long. You don't stay long enough in a studio to really become an integral part of a design problem at that point in time. Although at that time, and we'll probably get into this, the company, that place has changed over there. Right now, the guys that are working for me in that capacity are far more deeply involved in their program, less superficially involved than we were. There were so many of us there, And they were almost, they're sort of a luxury that you could use. And what they used the trainees for was to do renderings and pictures and paint, cover the walls with good-looking stuff and kind of make that sort of an impression, but always a very superficial kind of a... Not really into it, right. Right. My recollection, anyway. That's not true anymore, by the way. You don't have enough people to do that anymore.
Oh, I see.
At that time, they had the luxury of a lot of people, a lot of money, everything.
This was sort of a house in the period.
No question, it was when Ford really had the, at least the reputation, I think, as a pretty much of a design innovator and leader, and through the probably the success of the Mustang and a whole lot of other things we did. I think the atmosphere over there was one of leadership. You know, when you get in first place, you have this kind of a cocky, sort of a self-assured, and it that attitude translates into what you do. It reflects that.
So it must have been a sort of a heady experience.
Oh, yeah, I was pretty proud of what I did. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was the big leagues.
Yeah. Do you remember who working with anyone?
I was first hired at Ford Motor Company the first time around before I went in the service by Elwood Engel. And worked in the studio that he had for the time period of time I was there the first time.
It should have been the before the Navy.
Yes, before the Navy.
Was that the so-called Stiletto Studio?
No, that was called the Advanced Studio at that time. Advanced Studio, yeah. At the time, they were involved in the early stages of the Mustang program when I first came. They were doing Mustang proposals. And it was based on, at that time, they had these little projects running around. Remember the Cardinal? Does that pop up anywhere in your research? There was a Mustang based on a Cardinal, and there were several of them around the room. But the basic shape, the basic theme of the Mustang was taking place at that time. I recognized it 4 years later when it came out.
What did you think of Elwood Engel?
I was hardly anything of a close friend. I sort of stood in awe of the guy, and he was a very, how do I describe him? Maybe not flamboyant, but they would walk into the studio, and maybe it was the perspective I was looking at. I would look at this sort of a god walking into the studio and walking around and pointing around, and now that I'm in that position, you know that he's just another slug trying to make it.
Right, yeah.
But they would come in, and they would look to a trainee anyway, like some sort of a god who knew everything, let me put it that way. Yep, very much in command. Unlike now, you can't do that anymore. The management styles have changed. You no longer have emperors, as it were. You no longer conduct business that way. Thank God. I mean, it's...
In a way, it's
good. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, after you came back, who were you?
Yeah, let me try to remember what periods of time those were. A lot of people. Nobody stands out in my mind during that period of time. I worked with a lot of people. Maybe one of the early ones. Have you come across Alex Tremulous in your research, too, at Ford Motor Company? I sat next to Alex when he got fired, or the day he got fired. There was another guy I stood in awe of was Alex Tremulous the first time.
You know what happened?
No idea. I was too much separated from the politics. I don't know what was going on, but I know that he came in one day and packed his stuff and left, and he had had some sort of an altercation with somebody, and he was fired. But he was an amazing person. No question. He still is. He still is. Yes, and he was sort of inspirational to the kids that worked around, the young guys that worked around the place. He was the kind of guy, not only did you look up to him, but he did not avoid you, let's say. He got right in with the kids.
I believe the training program was one of his...
Sometime before I got there was when that happened.
I think that was while you were
in the service?
Yeah, I think it happened in the early...
No, because I think he was... That all happened before I went in the Navy, because he was fired while I was there the first time.
Well, the first time? Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was fired in 61 or 2, and I don't think he ever came back.
Is there any Aussie down there? So he was, in a sense, a sort of a guru.
Yeah, no question he was.
Yeah.
And an affinity for young people and new things and new ideas and all of those sort of things. And he's still that way to this day. You go talk to him and he's still the same kind of a guy. He likes people.
So,
I guess he was... I remember Alex and I remember Elwood Engel. The rest of the guys all kind of fade away somewhere.
So you're into the late 60s, early 70s. What kind of projects are you working on?
All right, you're probably more interested in me pinning down a spot in time where I can really remember what was going on, don't you? You're interested in the company.
I'm really more interested in the cross currents of
Unfortunately, I was I'm separated from it at that point in time. You know, you're.
Then you observe, in terms of the project you worked on, how they came about.
The one thing I can remember at those periods of time, there was a period of time when I worked for Joe Orris in a studio that Joe was director of.
What studio was that?
Ford Studio. Ford Joe was always the director of Ford Studio. I don't think he was ever director of anything else, was he? I'm not sure. That must have been in the late 60s or thereabouts. But Joe, and at those times, those people ran those studios pretty much with an iron hand in the sense that design came from the director. The director decided what was going to be done, and he told people, and they did it. It was not, the design did not flow uphill in those days, my recollection anyway. Now, maybe it's, once again, my perspective. I'm not sure.
There were some very, very tough-minded.
No question, yep. And good ones, too. Obviously, they had their finger on the pulse at that time. They knew darn good feeling for it. I don't think we have people that have that feeling for it today, or maybe you can't get that feeling for it today. I think that's probably the other idea. It was a lot simpler then. Relatively easy to decide what was going to succeed and what wasn't, because it was a sort of a predictability about design at that time, which is not there anymore. You knew that if a certain kind of a design was succeeding now, you could almost say you could almost predict what would succeed in 3 years, because there was a logical progression of things. Fads came in and they came out on an orderly cycle. Even the tail fins came in, they grew and grew and grew, and then they died, and that's predictable. Now, it's not like that anymore. Yep.
So, personally, Joe Orris would pretty much dictate the design from the concept to the...
He did, they did, yes. 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 Yeah, basically I contributed, I suppose, as a designer in that stage, maybe ideas to Joe. In other words, we might put sketches on the wall, and he might walk around there sometime, and he might see something he liked, and then he would then make it part of his vocabulary or his repertoire. But the design never grew out of a sketch, and rarely grew out of something that came up from the bottom. My recollection. Anyway. Maybe that's wrong. Does that jibe with what else you're getting from people?
Well, yeah, more or less. But, so you, now you've moved into a, in the early 70s, you've moved into you've got a promotion, and you've moved into something that looks fairly exciting.
Now, in this period of time, is where I'm going to get closer to the what's going on and maybe be able to remember it better. Let me try to remember that period of time. Advanced International. What did I do over there? Advanced International. Time really just slips by on you, doesn't it? No, I really don't. Why don't I? Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, okay. All right, now it's coming back to me. There was a period of time when I worked in a studio Don was in charge of. And that must have been Advanced International, right? That's the 74 and 75 period on this thing here. I worked for Don Del Rosa. I worked in a studio in the basement called... We did at that time, I think, pretty much, it didn't seem to me at that time, though maybe once again this perception is wrong, it didn't seem to me like there was an organized corporate plan that we were working on. We seemed to do what Don Del Rosa wanted us to work on. That's my impression of it anyway, is that we would work on a particular project and it would only be because Don thought it was worth working on and that he would invent it and we would go work on it. Now that's, once again, that's not like that anymore over there. And we did an awful lot of advanced projects that seemed to me to be a little frivolous and a little without any... I'm not sure why we did them. At this point in time, you can walk over to that building and there's nothing in that building that somebody isn't doing for some reason, and there's a big plan of some sort. There wasn't at that point in time. My first recollection that's going to do you much of any good in terms of the politics and what's happening is probably going to become, I hate to say it, only in the last less than 10 years is when I've been involved in the change over there and watched it happen. I think I can help you there.
Well, that would be very good, but before we get to that, see what you can extract from the Del Rosa studio in some detail. He had you working on it, and why?
Well, we worked on things. Don would get a bright idea. I can remember one occasion we, I know one thing we did a lot. Did this pop up before? Lee Iacocca was at the time, gosh, what was he? He wasn't president of the company at that time. He was something else. I'm not sure what he was at that time. But, it seemed to me he and Don spent a great deal of time talking to each other. At least Don felt that we did an awful lot of things because Don had talked to Lee, and Lee decided that he wanted this. And then I can remember these silly things like making cigar boxes. Is that popped up before? Don used to have these, we'd make them these consoles. That's what I mean by frivolous things. These consoles that would sit into the cars that would be fitted into Lee Iacocca's cars, and they would have these elaborate cigar boxes. And he spoke very expensive cigars. I guess he still does. And he kept a humidor. They would build a humidor into this thing so it would keep the cigar boxes. And he had a silver inlaid top on it. And at the time, I'm not sure. At the time, right now looking back on it, I think it's terrible. But at the time, it seemed okay to me. It was all right to do that sort of stuff. Looking back on it, it's another era. Right now, it seems terrible.
Well, was Don Rosa involved with Advanced Design at this point?
Don had, at that time, a studio called Advanced. He was director of it, and he was responsible for it. I wish I could tell you where he got his orders from on what to do. It was probably more orderly than I thought, but it didn't seem that way to me.
But the time you remember, you're in the
Yes, we did maybe one car for Don while we were there, but it never went very far. I worked for a fellow by the name of Dick Pettit at that time. Pettit, who was a manager at that time, and he still works over there. He's not a manager anymore. And we started a couple of cars over there, but I don't know that we ever did anything monumental or of any significance. One car maybe that might come to my mind. There was a car we did, and I'm not sure if it was at Gene or Don or both of them together somehow conceived this car, but it was a car that looked very much like an MG, an old MG TD or TF. Does that pop up anywhere in your files anywhere? It was a green car, and it was shown for quite a while on the auto show circuit. The name of that thing was what? It had freestanding lights and very reminiscent of an MG, and at that time, Gene and Don thought that there was and maybe rightfully so, that there was that kind of a car had some meaning out there, and there was a potential. Yeah.
And it was what?
Gosh, I can think of the name of that
thing.
It even had straps, of all things. You know, the luggage straps go over the luggage compartment in the rear. You have belts on the thing instead of the old MGs had a belt on there. It even had that on there. And that was, you're getting into an era now, which I wake nightmares sometimes once in a while when we went through that era, where we were extracting things like that and putting them on contemporary cars and sort of thinking, well, that's what's making the market tick. Now, maybe it was. I don't know. But in retrospect, it bothers me to even think about that period of time. Oh, 7, 8, 9 years ago, yeah, they had a strap on there. Maybe not that long ago. 79, I think. Now, I was involved in one car along the way, and I'm not. That was something later than that period, but it's one I'll never forget, and maybe this has popped up. We did it. Gene, towards the end of his career there, Gene, yeah, Bourdain, we did a car whose name won't come to me right now, but it was a Mark that we shortened to a two-passenger car, and it had these enormous pipes on the side of it, these chrome pipes. Is that one surfaced yet?
It has, but not by name.
Okay, I don't think I could name it. I'm not sure that it ever was named, but at that time, Gene became fascinated with the Clinet that he had bought, and there was that era was surfacing where there was these neoclassic cars were coming on, and Gene felt that that was the luxury, that epitomized the luxury automobile, and we took a Mark and had it sectioned to a two-passenger car by moving the windshield to the rear and effectively putting the driver in the rear seat and all the other things, so the hood became three or four feet longer than it was before, and on the outside of the car we made these pipes, fake pipes and headers like you might have on an old Auburn or a Deuce car, and spent enormous amounts of money and time. Lord knows what that cost, and as a designer that I ever spent 2 years making it or whatever we spent, I regret it, but I was assigned to that project. And that was almost at the end of the, Gene was, he was going to leave in a few years. I think you could see that happening, but his taste had gone, it wasn't his taste, what was it? His pulse or his touch on the market had gone. And he didn't change with the times, and he still thought that, maybe he didn't. I don't know what was going on in his mind. In retrospect, he had the right idea, just the wrong execution. It was equally wrong to dive, I think, in retrospect, too, to go completely to the European side. That was almost the other swing of the pendulum. That was equally probably, maybe not wrong. No, that isn't right. It isn't wrong. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Anyway, during that period of time, that was one of the monumental cars I remember working on that does not go too well in my memory.
Well, you moved into intermediate and compacts.
We look down where you are. Intermediate and compact, mid-70s. Intermediate and compact. All right, I've jumped ahead of you. The story I just told you comes from the 76 to 79 era. Intermediate and compact. I had a lot of assignments during that period. This may be interesting to you from the employee standpoint. Because there were, at that period of time, they were demoting people. If you recall, there was a period, I think it was in 75, is that the time at Surfaces? There was a giant cutback over there at the design center, and a lot of people were demoted and laid off, and it was all done by the seniority system. Basically, the first in, first out, however it went. So you'll see me, I was a design specialist in 75, which is a salary grade 9, and I was demoted to senior designer. That's a demotion, yeah, that's down one pay grade. And I remember Don Del Rosa called us in and called me in and told me that I was being demoted, but it was no problem. Literally everybody else in the building was, and it was all by the numbers, so it didn't hurt. But anyway, I was demoted during that period of time, but I was the last one on the list, the seniority list, to be demoted. So I was promoted again and demoted three more times. Now, it doesn't show on this thing, because they would always have somebody would retire, which would give you another slot, and up you'd go, and somebody would come through with another cutback, and down you'd go. So I didn't work very long in any one place there, as you can see, because every time I would get promoted or demoted, I would get transferred. So I don't remember what went on during that period. That was one of my promotions, was contingent on the fact that a job had opened up in industrial design and graphics. So they called me in one day and said, if you want to get re-promoted again, there's a job up there. So I went up there and worked. I went up and worked for Jim Quinlan during that period. Quinlan.
Oh, yes.
And I worked on the museum here, as a matter of fact. Our project was the redo of the interior of the Henry Ford Museum. So I worked in the early period, the first 6 months of that project. I worked up there. Came off well. Yep. That was an interesting period in my career, coming over here. We spent time, I never even knew it was over there. At the end of a year, I knew every piece of stuff in there. That was an interesting period, and we worked on company airplanes at that time, interiors. But this one over here was probably the major one. It was very interesting. Well, a lot of other people worked on it beside myself, but I worked for Jim at that period of time. So that's why, and John Najar at that time was, I think he was somehow involved in that. Then after a little bit of time up there, I got the opportunity to get out of there, and while I found that fascinating, I was not that's not my love. Go back to cars. So now into luxury car design, and this is where I'm, from here on in, I could give you some good, I can be more specific about what was going on.
You were there for a good period.
ID, you mean? Industrial design?
No.
Okay, yes, I was. I went into that studio. Yes, into that studio at the time they were designing the 80 Lincolns and Marks, the cars that are on the road today, the big cars. And we were at that time reacting to downsizing. Now, the crush was downsizing, and our philosophy at that time was, or Jeans was, this is basically Jeans, downsize the car but make it look as much as possible like it didn't get downsized. So the philosophy behind that car was just that. Try to give them everything they had before and downsize it quietly so you don't see it. And that's why those cars look the way they do. And why did we downsize?
Did you do it in weight reduction?
I suppose there was some weight reduction. But at that time also, now it's another thing that's big changes. This popped up in your research. At that time, a designer was really somewhat removed from all of the, say, what the car weighed. I mean, we cared what it weighed, but we were not really involved in it. It was not something that we even talked about very much. Somebody else took care of that. I presume Gene may have been involved a little bit in it, but not the designers. Now, today that's not true. The designers who work for me care how much the car weighs. So we were only reacting at that time, as far as I knew, to the fact that we had a downsize because of the fuel crisis.
The mandate was to downsize.
Gene never came around and told us that. Gene was not the kind that communicated to the guys. You know, he didn't have a meeting and tell the guys what he wanted to do. You had to interpret that from the orders, from the commands, let's say.
What was his modus operandi?
Gene worked by, I think the way he did this was, is he, when there was a particular problem, a particular car being designed that somehow he was interested in, you'd have him there every day. Has this popped up yet? Have you seen this one yet? If you were working on a car, and I remember in the, during the 80 mark, maybe even during the midday, the car with the pipes I was talking about, when we would work on it, Gene would come down every day and spend the day in the studio. And you would fetch him coffee, and he would, you'd make, as the designer, you'd make small talk with Gene all day long, because he, his presence was part of his style. And when there was a particular project there, he'd sit right there and he would tell the modelers exactly how he wanted it. And then maybe at the, some point in time he'd say it was done and you'd never see him again, or you wouldn't see him again. So he spent many days in that studio with a cup of coffee watching it happen.
Can you sketch out a typical studio design day? In other words, you said the modelers are there with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, at that time, that period of time, I was a senior designer, and I would be working from probably some, I would be in charge of a car, basically in charge of a clay car, but by that I meant I would be basically coordinating what was happening on that car through the modelers. I would basically tell the modelers what to do with, except when Gene would come in at night and tell, unless somebody higher than I was, to tell them to do something different. But to the extent that I could, the senior designer was in control of the car.
Now, where had you gotten your work?
Earlier on, we'd probably had some sort of, we'd done tape drawings, are you familiar with tape drawings and illustrations, and we had some idea what the car was going to look like. And well, I was the renderer, and I was the sketcher.
Oh, you were.
And the layout people would be the engineers, and their input to the car was basically in the studio to keep us honest, in other words, to tell us what had to be located where, and to, they often checked us at night to see what we had done during the day and told you when it was wrong. So I guess I told the modelers what to do as a senior designer, to the extent that I could. Oh yeah, no question, right in the middle of the studio. You've been in a studio, haven't you? They haven't changed. The building's the same as it was. It's the same building I walked into 25 years ago.
Would you have a bridge?
Oh yeah, there'd be several bridges in every studio, and the clay model would be sitting in the bridge. And in the case, let's talk about that one period of time where I have some good memories of the 80 Lincoln. There would be, in one would be a Lincoln, and another one would be a Continental, and another one would be a two-door, let's say, one in each bridge going. And depending on what phase of the program we were in, if we were in the theme phase of the program, we would be doing theme explorations of the car. We did some. Well, by theme, I'm talking about what the styling looks like, what the styling image of the car is. And it's character lines and sections and lines and that sort of thing, as opposed to where the windshield is located, that's packaged. Or where the, how high the roof is, that's packaged.
Exterior, but non-packaged.
Package has been decided by this point in time, or pretty close to it. Once again, things have changed at the design center. I never had any real, felt I had any real input or effect on the package at that point in time, even though package engineering is part of the design center. Gene,
package was the dimensional object.
Package is the, it's the science of defining the spaces within the car, in other words, how high the car is, where the windshield is, where the seat is, how much headroom is in the car, how much foot room, and all of those have an effect on where the skin of the outside of the car is. Yes, but at that point in time, the package was seems to have been decided off in a closed room somewhere. The designers had no input into the package at that point in time. Now, that's not true anymore. Oh, no, Design Center didn't. But it was done, I think, at a very high level in the Design Center. I think Gene was probably where the package got decided, because the package engineer worked for Gene. A guy named Jim Bell at that time was the package engineer. Has his name surfaced anywhere in this? So those things were done, as far as I was concerned, behind closed doors somewhere. All I did was put styling on it. Once again, remember I said the superficial kind of an approach to it. It's different. It's a lot different out there now. So, yes, sure. How long it was, how high it was, where the windshield was, where the side glass was, how wide it was, a whole lot of control points on the car.
So your job was then at this point?
Styling. What sort of a skin goes over the top of those points, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
The sheet metal and all the ornamentation, the taillights, the headlights, the grill. And at that point in time, we focused on, well, that particular car, if you recall, is a very crisp kind of a car, composed of very flat planes. And that was probably the result of the popularity at that time of the Italian kind of a school of styling, the Giugiaro school, which was beginning to emerge there. If you get into design, you'll find he probably influenced that whole era that way. Giugiaro, G-U-I-G-A-R-O, Italian designer. He brought out a whole lot of these very crisp, almost folded, plain-looking cars. And we jumped on that bandwagon for all it was worth. And those cars looked just like that, of course. And we did some terrible things sculpturally to the cars in order to achieve that, not from a designer standpoint, surface-wise. You know, it just something does not want to be... You cannot make a car out of a lot of folded simple planes, but we did anyway. We did some bad things, I think, in the design wise, in order to achieve that.
You still call it fudging?
Call it what?
Fudging.
Fudging?
Or is that too?
You might, though. By fudging would mean that you have to arrive at some point in the car with a given. You have to cross over a given point, and you're at a point over here, and the surface that gets you from here to there is not the one you want, so you cheat it somehow to get it to do what it doesn't want to do. So we created that era, that series of cars right there, and then probably the next car that comes to my mind is the current Continental on the road today, the 81 Continental, is that right? The one with the sinking line that copied basically the Eldorado. Not the Eldorado, the Seville. And that might be interesting how that one happened. We were doing a car at that point in time that did not look anything like that. And we got wind, either through some of these spy photographs, of the Seville that was being done. And the Seville was that very much of a, almost a neoclassic kind of a style with that sinking line on the body side. And that car was probably reminiscent maybe of a Daimler or something. It was a car of a Daimler that has a similar line. Like, we got wind of that. And we started, if I'm not mistaken, we did a tape drawing, or a full-size drawing of a car that we thought represented that photograph we had. And so we changed that design of that car in the last couple of months before approval to change it totally over to get this kind of a neoclassic kind of a style into it. We did that very quickly in that studio. Now, it seemed to me at that point in time, I was working somehow with Jack at that point in time. I don't think Jack was Telnax. Jack was not the director at that time. I mean, Jack must have been the director, but he was not the executive director that he is now. So Gene was still there. But we did that car in a very short period of time. We worked with Jack on that one, and that car's on the road today. It met with mild success. In retrospect, I'm not sure it was the right thing to do, but you never know what would happen if you had done something different, so you don't know. It's a current car that's out there now. Current Continental. Yeah, not the Lincoln, not the town car, the Continental. It's been pretty well. I mean, you know, if you look at the overall period of time they built that car and sold it, they made a lot of money off that car, so that was a good decision. It was a good decision. I participated rather heavily in that one. That was one that I think I did the tape drawing of that car, that inspired the car and then did the model and on down the line. And then I probably went from there to the Continental. Somehow I ended up working for Fritz Mayhew right shortly thereafter in another studio. What's that about? Design specialist, small car, advanced in pre-production design. Okay, that was where I tangled up with Fritz Mayhew. And at that time, the designers were beginning to feel this urge that there was something going wrong at Ford Motor Company, the design center, that these cars that we were doing were not what we saw going on or what we thought was going on. So there was an undercurrent going on at Ford Motor Company at this point in time, and I think maybe that Continental was the first indication of it. And it was the Continental was a car which was consisted not of soft lines, but before that time everything was parallel and perpendicular. The E.D. Lincolns has parallel lines and perpendicular lines. That car was the first one where we started to bend lines. We said cars are going to go soft now. Our cars are going to, they're going to change. There are no more of these square cars. But we just bent them in one dimension. If you'll take a look at those cars, the side view of that car is curved, but all the corners are still squares. So it's a box, but somebody has cut some lines on it. And we were convinced the next stage was you begin to soften the surfaces up, you begin to change that. So there was an undercurrent going on there. The designers wanted to go one way, and Gene did not want to go that way. Gene Bourdain did not feel that that was the way the company should go. So there was a, there was kind of a smoldering current there sitting there waiting to happen. And probably the chance we got to do it was on the Tempo Topaz, where we sort of broke out there by doing a tape drawing and a sort of a last-minute heroics kind of an effort to turn a program around to do a Tempo Topaz. And that was the emergence of our, at least the one that I was on. The current philosophy of styling over there happened, was born then. And the Thunderbird happened about the same time in another studio. Yes. Yep. Right. Right.
Did any of those cross currents fill your mind?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we felt those very strongly.
Can you tell us a bit about them?
Well, I think Jack and Gene. I think they knew that they didn't agree with each other, and of course they knew they were pulling in different directions, and each of them. No idea where Jack came from. I mean, it all happened in front of my eyes. I don't know why. I think the one reason being that Jack has a very incredible sense of, you know, Jack isn't a real strong, I don't know if he's a hands-on designer or not, but his real strong point is a feeling for what's right, what's going to happen, and a good feeling for people, too, I think, if they're kind of people. So exactly how he popped up in the middle of that, I'm not even sure. There was an era where he was in Australia, and he popped back up from Australia, and exactly why Jack...
Port of Europe.
Yeah, that's right, he came back from Europe with Fritz, and they did the Mustang. That's true.
Fritz was there with him?
Fritz was the manager of the studio that did the Mustang when Jack just came back from Europe.
Okay.
So I think that's probably Jack's, and obviously Gene did not have a great deal to do with the Mustang because wasn't his kind of car. It kind of happened, not really in spite of him, but not at, he didn't have his hands on it anymore like he did with design before that time.
This is the one with the egg crate grill.
And yeah, the 79 Mustang.
Sloping.
Yep.
Really began the aero revolution.
No question.
Yeah.
No question.
And Jack was
I think Jack was pretty much the doctor of that car, indirectly at least, anyway. I think he was the director of the studio that did it.
First of the European influences.
I think so, yeah. But we hadn't really reached the bottom. We hadn't bottomed out yet. We're like an alcoholic that hadn't hit bottom yet. We didn't really know. I mean, I think the bottom was when we probably put out the Cougar and the T-Bird, the 80 Cougar and T-Bird. That's when we knew we really hit bottom. Yeah, they were nothing. They were nowhere. And you couple that at the same time with a fuel crisis, and all of a sudden everything seemed to come together and go totally negative to everything we had done so far. You know, I mean, it didn't all happen at once, but all of those factors came together, and we just had a horrible reputation during that period of time for styling. They told us our cars were boxy, and that they were the boxes that the GM cars came in when we did silver boxes, they did silver bullets. You remember that?
Yeah.
It just all went to pieces on us there, and we basically started over right there.
So at this point, Gordon A. is leaving.
Gene left, but he didn't leave for a, you know, he used to linger for a long time. I know he broke his, he was off, he was sick for a while in there. Broke his leg, I think, in the studio. And I believe it was a period of time where he was ill. So he was kind of not particularly present, and then Jack exerted more and more influence during that period of time, and then eventually Gene retired.
Do you have the feeling that it would be too simplistic to say that Gordon A. represented the old guard, and Telnak represented the
It is and it isn't. I think it's just a matter of, I think everybody that's a designer is going to reach, and I haven't got there yet because I have tried extremely hard as I've gotten older as a designer not to get myself frozen in a period of time. You know, I've noticed, you know, how some guys You'll even see the way they dress will happen, too. All of a sudden, their styles will stop at a certain period of time, and they will not change anymore.
Right.
I think that's what happened with Gene. It didn't happen for a long time. He was, what, 60 years old when it happened. That's pretty old for that to happen, but I think that's what happened. So as a result, Gene represented that, but I think he still had a tremendous feeling of the pulse of the car business, what it takes to make it tick. It was just that his fashion sense stopped. Oh, no question. I bet, as a matter of fact, I bet Gene is smiling today at the way those cars are selling. But it isn't because those are so much on style at the moment. They're on size, and they're yeah.
You're obviously way from the future. You're very sensibly picking up a lot of the old tradition.
Oh, but almost, if it was up to us 2 years ago, we'd have just stopped building those cars. I'm talking about the designers now. And the designers don't always have the greatest sense for that sort of thing either. I'm not so sure we have a good sense for it at all. As a matter of fact, as I get older, I think we have not a very good sense of that.
This is a classic case.
No question.
When that
sure.
Your designers are ready to break cleanly with tradition.
Sure.
Start off in
a
new direction.
Sure.
And did in that the product insisted on keeping the cars for sale.
Yeah, but they weren't so terribly clairvoyant either. They're just looking at a piece of paper somewhere, and it made sense because there was a certain number of selling, and they made a profit and everything else. They're not visionaries, in my opinion, of anything. They're interpreters of. Facts and figures, so they're not the right people to give credit for that to. They don't know the difference.
But in any event, you are in the midst of a sort of bifurcated vision.
I have a good sense for it at all. As a matter of fact, as I get older, I think we have not a very good sense of that.
This is a classic case.
No question. Yeah, but they weren't so terribly clairvoyant either. They're just looking at a piece of paper somewhere, and it made sense because there was a certain number of selling, and they made a profit and everything else. They're not visionaries, in my opinion, of anything. They're interpreters of figures, facts and figures. So. They're not the right people to give credit for that to. They don't know the difference.
But in any event, you are in the midst of a sort of bifurcated vision. You're definitely in the...
That's strictly a business decision. But I think we have learned something here, though. I've learned something in this sequence here. The public did not come along with the designers as fast as we had hoped. In other words, I think a certain number of them did. But at the time, remember, we had bottomed out now. We never looked or felt worse than we did for the ADT bird on the road. We're standing there, the laughing stock of the industry and styling. And so literally, in order to get out of this, you had to almost have a revolution. You know, a country politically gets to the point where the only way to clean house is to revolt. And I think that's the situation we were in. Now, in retrospect, the public didn't revolt as fast as we did, or they didn't catch anything taken. They still haven't. Oh, yeah. But still, they were the laughing stock.
When you went to conventions and gatherings with other designers,
Designers aren't a good fraternity. I don't know if you noticed whether you go that surface shade or not. Very few designers. There is no such thing as a professional organization where we all get together and car designers. That's an industrial IDSA. That's not, there are not many car designers that belong to that.
Oh, I see.
Very few, as a matter of fact. So there is no real organization where we get together. I have a couple of college friends, but that's about all.
No professional organization.
No. Whatsoever. I don't know why. I never understood why. Maybe you'll find that out. You have to ask why they don't. Mostly because it's so competitive that you don't really want to share your, let's say if you've got a certain something that you think you have, you're not about to go tell somebody else about it. That's the last thing you want to do. You want to make hay with it.
There's no need for a professional.
No, but I think a professional organization would add some status to the profession. In other words, it would be the, you know, this book I'm talking about, publishing The Wise, it would be the where something like that would originate. Doctors and lawyers have done a good job of policing their profession and making their profession profitable through organizations.
As we were just saying, they're probably going to be crying.
Not national standards, but trading information among each other, I think, is something that would be nice to go to a convention somewhere and just listen to somebody give you papers on design, what he thinks about it. Yeah. Well, I'm not about to give a paper on what I think by design to a bunch of other designers. Sure. Sure. I can give you a lot of rumors. I hate to sit here and repeat a lot of things that I heard at the time, because I have no idea if they're true or not. What is the status of what you're doing here in terms of that?
This will be made available to only those that you want.
Okay. Well, I don't deal in really rumors. I almost rather not, if you don't mind. I'd really rather not get into that. What I know is facts. I don't mind talking about that. But I heard a lot of things at the time about what was going on, and I'd really rather not to, you know, let somebody tell you that knows rather than me.
No, I'd rather have your perceptions.
Okay. Okay. I'll give you my perceptions of what I thought when I saw was happening. And there was obviously something of a power struggle going on in the company there at the time from us, because Gene and Jack, let's say, were certainly coming at design from two different directions, and they did not... I don't think there were any open confrontations. Jack wasn't the type. That would not happen. They don't stand there and yell at each other or scream at each other. I don't know of anything other than the fact that I knew that if I was affiliated with anybody, it was with Jack, because I was working on some cars, and he seemed to like what I do. I've done several things with Jack or for Jack at a period of time, and I think Jack trusts and likes what I do. So I would probably be more closely associated with Jack. And, what can I tell you that would help give you some depth to that? That wouldn't be just a bunch of gossip. Not a great deal, except we did work on these cars that I was talking about. For instance, this Tempo Topaz happened by having us. There was a certain car going in the middle of the studio that Gene was apparently approving of anyway, or he was in on the workings of this car. And Fritz Mayhew and I turned a blackboard around and did a tape drawing of a car that we thought was different, the way we thought the car would be. And it was the beginning of the introduction of the Wedge. Have you heard that one at all? A wedge-shaped car, a car which is higher, the lines are basically rising to the rear. And it was a wedge-shaped car that was soft and aerodynamic. And turned that board around and did that, and it seemed to me we showed that to Jack somehow, and I remember how we did this, but somehow privately, Jack, I look at this car and said, that's really great, that's really what I want to do on the Tempo Topaz. And I think the T-Bird guys maybe were doing something of the same down there. And exactly how or why we got it on the T-Bird, I'm not sure, but somehow Jack got us to the point where we got to make a clay model of this car. Remember, we made it on a... We started the thing on a Saturday, and we finished it in about a week and a half, a very quick clay model of a car. And they surveyed surveyed that car. They took that car to a survey, and the car had a very high rear end by those standards. Now, today it's no problem, but by those standards. They took it to a survey in Chicago, and they surveyed some people. I remember one of the quotes. No, they take a clay model.
Oh, the whole clay model.
Whole model. If you got into that at all, they'll take them to. They'll take the.
Full or the three?
The full size. Put it on a truck, take it to someplace, and put it in a warehouse, and put a lot of other comparison cars to it, and invite a lot of people in, and have them. A research firm in Chicago conducts a survey, ask people all stupid questions about the car, what you like, what you don't like. They try to break it all. They try to boil it all down the end to a numerical rating and into a. They can tell you whether your car is better or worse than the other cars and how you're doing. Anyway, this car obviously scored very, very low because it was this wedge, and people, especially in Chicago, which is not exactly the hotbed of car design in the world, or at least not to us, didn't understand this car at all. It looks like a car that somebody jacked the rear end on. There were a lot of comments like some kid got a hold of the car and jacked the rear end up, and one fella said that he'd just come from a zoo, and that car to him looked like a hyena in heat. And I presume a hyena in heat must stick its tail up in the air or something like that, or I don't know. So a survey... Oh, yeah, well, it was, yeah. But at that time, we were almost rebellious. Once again, I said we were at the bottom, and we knew that you couldn't, you had to shock, you had to come out of this fighting. You couldn't just ease out of this. You couldn't make a little change. You actually had to be rebellious. So we said at that time, I don't care if they hate it. They're going to love it in a few years, and we're going to do it anyway. Basically, yeah, and I suppose Jack was in on this, too. And so we felt at that time, and I, even in retrospect, rightly so, that's what had to happen. So we did some cars there that were basically without support from the standpoint of survey results or the average guy walking in our studio did not like our cars. Oh, yeah. So they approved that Tempo Topaz, and then the company, only with a lot of support, or I guess urging from Jack. I don't think they would have done it voluntarily. Jack had to stand up there and say, I believe in this kind of a car and that we need to change in order to... Oh yeah, the design subcommittee, and that sort of a structure hasn't changed. The designs are approved by the design subcommittee and have been for as long as I can remember, which consists of, at the moment, Don Peterson, the president, the chairman of the board, Caldwell, the vice president for design and product planning, which is William Clayford, Don Kopka, who at that time, the structure was different there when Don Kopka came in. By the way, there's another interesting thing. Have you gotten into that at all, how that one happened? I'm not sure who else is on the design committee, but no more than one or two other people. So at the very top level of the company, and they approve the designs. And always has been.
Once that approval is given, is that locked in?
Yes, that's you have to go execute the car like they saw it, or else go back and tell them why you couldn't or why you changed your mind. Now, you can go back and tell them you changed your mind, or something changed, but you cannot change without their approval. So they put a rubber stamp on it. Or put a stamp on it.
Where'd you go from there?
Well, after the design subcommittee approves the appearance of the car, which is just a checkpoint in a big process, at some point, someday, they are scheduled to approve the appearance of the car. Once they approve the appearance, you go and execute the car to that appearance. So you engineer the car, you do all of the releasing of the car, but that's the appearance objective they've set. And still to that, this day, it's that way. No. That's only a checkpoint in the design approval process. The DAP, which is that's a creature of the last 6 years, another whole subject. But the DAP is nothing more than to describe that process of approving an automobile from the day you start the business plan until the day you build a car. Is what, 66 months total, I think now? 66 months. The DAP is just the time span of what happens at what point in time along the way. They always had something like that, but it was never documented. It was sort of it wasn't written down anywhere that we will do it this way. We sort of did each program. Somebody somewhere must have said, we better approve this at this point. Somebody must have set out a work plan for the car, for each car. But each car might be different. Now, all cars conform to a standard. So anyway.
So the Tempo Topaz.
Yes, the design subcommittee approved the appearance of the car in spite of the high rear end and all of the other things. Although I don't go to the design subcommittee. Only that's a very small meeting. Nobody. Oh, yeah. No, I wouldn't. Oh, gee, that could be, but that could be, I don't. I've never been. I've been to a design subcommittee meeting, but only as a almost like a waiter or something. Like I would be there because I had to put something on a car. I had to do something manual. There you go.
So you and Mayhew have gotten, and Jack have gotten the okay.
We just executed the car. In other words, the car was engineered and built over a period of 3 or 4 years. Oh, yeah, it felt very good. It fell on top of the world. Maybe at that time, we were so bold at that point in time, and we were so convinced that we had this revolution was necessary, which I'm sure all revolutionaries are they not? That we never even looked over your shoulder. You never looked back. And we were just on a roll. I mean, it was going to be that way, and then not only that, next car is going to be softer, and we're going to do this. And I think in the climate of the company, we were really, there was a revolution there at that point in time. And all for the better. No, at that point in time, see, the company went along with it, and rear guards in the Ford Motor Company stayed quiet until, like right now, there's one servicing, as you can imagine, over the Panther, the success of the LTD, and the success of the Lincolns, and, you know, the rebounding. The rear guard, or the quiet, what do you want to call it, the dissenting conservatives now come forward and say, that's the politics of the company.
So you and Fritz and Jack.
I am in it.
Accelerated program.
Oh yeah. The timing had to do a lot of things to. Now that's one thing the DAP is trying to stop. By the way, they call that last minute heroics. Well, you come in at the last minute and you've been working for 2 years on a certain kind of a car, and you say, throw all that in the wastebasket. We're going to do this car here, and we start over again at the last minute. That was the Ford Motor Company way for a long time. And the reason is dialing or design, if there's a problem, is that you've got to make your mind up so far in advance of what's going to work that oftentimes you'll make up your mind in good faith. A year or two will go by and something will change out there. And all of a sudden your two-year-old decision doesn't look so good anymore. Well, the climate change or the market change. So there's always that nagging temptation to say, well, let's see, if we accelerated this and if we did that and we did the other thing, we paid some overtime and we did this, we could save ourselves. We used to do that all the time, and we still do. The T-Bird was the same way. I wasn't on the T-Bird program, but because it was so closely allied with ours, and it was another Jack Telnack program, one where he was sort of attempting to do similar things as he was with the Templar Topaz. There was a car approved called the Probe. Has that surfaced anywhere in here? Oh, there was a car called the Probe 3, which was done by the design staff. And it was a nice show car, aerodynamic car, but at the time, they approved it as the theme for Thunderbird. You know, when you take a show car, it's like taking all the features off a woman that weighs 110 pounds and has a beautiful figure and putting them on somebody that weighs 200 and does not have a good figure. The fact you got the same features does not make it. So they turned over, they threw that car over in last minute heroics and put in a new car, a new Thunderbird, which is the one on the road today. I think that that's still Jack Telnack, but I think the major source of that inspiration was still the European influence, which is the same as the Templar Topaz. At that time, we felt that during the period of the 80s, you had the combination of the fuel crisis, the boxy cars, and all of this, you know, just driving, just bottoming out. The only place we could look for people that were doing cars that were better than we were in Europe. And for the first time in my life as a designer, I suddenly bought and read every European car magazine around. Up to that time, could have cared less what they did over there. All of a sudden, it was the only place we could turn to. The only place to look for inspiration. So all of our cars went European. BMW, of course, was our.
Yes.
I don't have much contact with the Escort. The Escort was done, and it was done under Gene. I don't think Jack had a great... Well, Jack comes to something to do, but I honestly think Gene had more to do that than Jack did, except that probably one of the stories that you'll find in there was that the guys over here, there was the program started as a worldwide car. We do the same car for the entire world. And the people over here in Design Center didn't feel there was any way that a European design would sell over here, and I think that came mostly from his camp. And they tried hard to, at every opportunity to not do the European car, and they, in the end, did not do the European car. They did their own version of it. Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a lot of. I wasn't around on that program. I can't tell you a great deal about it. Bob. The 80 current marker Continental? No, neither one of those. I don't need to do those. After not too long after the Topaz, Temple Topaz. Let me see. When somewhere around 81, maybe it's 82. The Tempo Topaz was basically underway. It was being engineered. Jack transferred Fritz and myself to the Taurus group. Yeah, we went over to start to do the Taurus one, and I think Jack felt that Fritz was the right guy to do that car, and Fritz, either he or Jack, I'm not sure, felt I was the one to go along and work on it as well. So we went over there to the Taurus program.
Amazing liquor when I. The
Taurus program was at that time the company was still hot on the European influence. Was what was going to save us was that the company was basically going European. They brought over Ray Everts. His name popped up at all. A design exec from Europe, who was an American, worked in Europe for 7 or 8 years. They brought him over. Many years ago, 8-10 years ago. Brought him over and put together a group to do this Taurus, which was all new from the ground up platform. Oh, I'm sure. I've heard, and nobody's ever told me. Once again, this is a rumor. I should be doing this, but they said that. Somebody has said, get him over here, because somebody like Peterson would say, get a European over here to do this car. Rumor, I don't know, no facts. Peterson was very up on the European cars, and he even had some Europeans over here to do interiors. I know he brought a couple of guys over to work in the studio there. But anyway, get a European over here, put together a team, and put this Taurus together. We were still in this, you know, we had done this Tempo Topaz, and we'd done the Thunderbird, and we wanted to go another further step down that line. So they put together a team, and we started from the ground up with that car, and I think if we had a guideline for that car, is that nothing was going to be like anything out there today. No matter what it was, it was going to be different. The door handles were going to be different. Everything was going to be different. And if there was ever an intelligently designed car, it's that one where everything was thought out and done for the reason. It will still, knowing what I know about the marketplace today, it will have a sector that it appeals to and another sector that ain't going to like it. So. Similar to like the T-Bird and Temple Topaz.
What were your influences on the
Taurus? During the period of the time on the Taurus, I went over there as a design specialist, and you'll see I changed to a design manager. So I was the design manager of the Taurus project. So a great design influence, I would say. 50% of it anyway was probably come from me. 50% from Ray Everts. Maybe 30, 30, 30. Fritz, myself, and Ray Everts probably. In terms of the design, now Ray was the leader of the team and probably was executing a more. He was overall guiding it, but maybe I'm guiding the actual execution of it. Yes, yep. And oftentimes, Jack, but not too much Jack. Jack did not really try to guide this team anymore. I don't think he tried to tell his team too much what to do. He let it do what they wanted to. So I think the car is truly the efforts of the team that was doing it.
Going back to this bifurcation of the design.
A car came out of the event studio, but like you've probably gotten into this politics the way it's set up over there. They're gonna, no matter what they do, you're never gonna hand a car from one designer to the other. When there's anything left that the guy can do, he's gonna change. You just don't do that. A designer, unfortunately, is integrally linked to a car, and you take away the person and the design's gonna crumble. So they transferred a car to us with a given design, but essentially we did not use it. We did our own design. And that always happens. You cannot. It's two very special designers that can take somebody else's design and just execute it. Sketches mostly. That's the way you communicate with another designer. You do a sketch of a kind of a car and you Well, yeah, but they're the essence of the car is described in the sketch. I can do a sketch of the car and describe the essence of the design. I can't tell you exactly how wide it is or exactly what the flavor of it is expressed. So that's the way we would do it. We would agree that a certain sketch or a certain tape drawing or rendering was the way we wanted to go, and then we would go do it. It's just a full-size drawing of the side view of a car. Yes. Well, just tape, black tape. Different widths. It's just like a pencil. I mean, it's just like a line. It's nothing more than a line. That's just so much more quicker. It's so much quicker to put on the car. You can take a line from there to there in 30 seconds. No. On a board. Like, if I wanted to do a picture of something on that wall, and I was going to do it, I would either need a very large pencil.
Oh, I see.
Or else a piece of roll of tape, which is just efficient.
But do you have the...
Describing something, in curve? Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, sure. In various widths, it'll curve. It'll curve in any width. It'll curve. You can make a little circle with it if you want. You never seen that? You should go over and see it someday. It's called photographic tape, but it's black masking tape. Yeah, in various widths, down to an eighth of an inch, 3 inches. Yeah, they actually established a room. They actually established an interior and exterior studio for the first time. The same group was going to do the car, inside and outside, which we had a problem. Not only with our Temple Topaz and T-Birds. If you look at them from a style designer standpoint, the two designers had two different philosophies on the outside and the inside of the car. And I think that was the result of the exterior guys turned it around, and we knew what we were after. The interior guys didn't seem to quite understand that, and they tried to turn their car around, but they never really quite caught the European-looking interior that should go along with the exterior of the car. They didn't make it together. So Temple Topaz and T-Bird are selling just fine. Sure, no problems with them. Wish they'd sold better. They succeeded in their objective, which is to turn our styling image around. We're no longer the people don't think of the Ford Motor Company now as being old and in terms of styling, old and backward and conservative and all of those things. We are, like us or not, maybe you don't like it, but you have to admit it's progressive. GM cars came in. I remember hearing that around the 70s, late 70s. I guess I'm the hit and run man. I only worked on the Taurus for about a year until such time as the theme was settled down and approved, and then I got sent on to another studio again, which is where I am now. Fritz and I both did, as a matter of fact. Been off the Taurus. The studio we're in right now is the Thunderbird. I am manager of the Thunderbird and the Cougar and the Mustang and the LTD, I guess we have too. But basically, Thunderbird, Cougar, Mustang, and Capri studio. And our project now is a new Thunderbird, of course. We're going to start a new Thunderbird now. I think that's why Jack has got us where we are right now. And we've also done some facelifts along the way, but anyway. So I'm going to get a chance to do the Thunderbird over again next. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
We're at a crossroads now from the philosophy standpoint, and that is that we have done these aero cars. We've sort of been naughty, as it were, and I told you about we've succeeded in doing that. We've shaken the image. Now the question is, what do you do if you were to say we're in first place? And we may think we're anyway, styling-wise, we're leading the pack. Now when you're leading the pack, it's not so easy to decide where to go next. When you're in last place, it's easy. You head for the guy. You follow the guy going to first, right? At that time, it was the Europeans. And we've succeeded in effectively getting out in first place. Now the question is, what do we do now? Do we do it even more? Do we go, for instance, if the cars are round, do we make them even rounder? Or do we cycle back and start getting tighter again and squarer and stiffer? Or precisely what do we do? And we're holding that debate right now. And I don't know what the answer is. We're going to look at a couple of different directions. But it's hard to tell where this market is going right now, where car design is going. I don't know whether you sense it or not, but I've been around long enough and I've seen enough of these. A designer always thinks that what he thinks today is what he's going to think forever, and that's not true. If there's one thing, it's going to change. I mistrust a little bit what's going on out there now.
And what is it?
Well, this almost conservative swing in the car. This conservative mood, I guess, let's say, that's sitting out there right now. Well, I think the illustration of that is best by the way that the Continentals are selling, and the way that all of these conservative cars are selling. General Motors cars are very conservative, selling very well. Japanese cars are conservative, selling very well.
But soft.
Not as soft as ours.
No, true.
And not as radical as ours. So it's hard to say.
You would prefer to move ahead in a radical direction?
I'm not sure. Oh, would I prefer? Personal preference? Yeah, I would keep right on going. I mean, I'd never look back.
Right. In fact, I saw a concept car coming in.
It isn't so obvious though, because what you're doing is trying to sell cars, not satisfy yourself. So I don't know. There's some soul searching to do.
What's ahead in the Cougar Mustang pre-line?
Well, there are some plans, but we aren't doing any, at the moment the United States is not doing any new Mustangs and Capris. Probably what you're reading is true, where you're saying we're going to build a new Japanese Mustang, right, maybe in 1980, whatever it is, 87. So basically we're not going to do those cars over again, other than to facelift them. So. Yeah, it appears as though, now this is my own guess, is that the company is going to concentrate on building large and luxury cars here, designing and building them, and getting the other ones somewhere else, Europe or Japan or some other source. So we're going to turn into a design office for large and luxury cars. Designed in Japan or designed in Europe or something other than here. That's the way it appears to me anyway. Well, it's a natural progression. I only thing you can do about it. I'm not about to demand they do something differently. It's okay. I don't care. Any kind of car is okay with me. I'm not fussy about what kind of car it is. It doesn't bother me. No, any car is okay. Although I do like to work on cars where you can spend some money on. When you design a compact car, they're usually so cost conscious that it's a designer that's restrictive. It's nice to have some money to spend.
So the new
TV don't know. Now, you know, there's a lot of philosophies to entertain, and we're entertaining them all. One of them is to assume that you're doing okay out there now, and make a gentle change in that car so it's recognizable from the old one, and to keep those buyers. And that's the scenario that says everything's okay. We got the right car out there. All we want to do is update it a little bit and keep the buyers. And there's another one that says there's not enough buyers of that car. We need to attract some new people who don't like it now. What does it take to get them? So that's the kind of thing a designer is paid to do. And it's what I like to do best, by the way, is to go through that period. I love this period of a car. Oh, the initial period where there's just the sheet of paper is blank and you're trying to set the philosophy of the car.
So, in fact, the designer...
No question. A planner, marketing... engineering. I sit in now on. I'm sure that managers did not do this in the past. I listen to every meeting. I know, every meeting about structure. I listen to the engine meetings. You know what's going on in the engines, and I really know everything about that car. Cooling is a problem. Is something we get in on. And my designers know a lot more about it than they did before. So it's a much matured profession from that standpoint.
Well,
so we can have to give them
on.
Sure.
Each mark.
No. It's not organized that way. Each studio has only a design, an engineering, a studio resident engineering function, which is nothing more than an advisory function, and a clay modeling function. That's the studio. And we interface with body engineering and the rest of the components of the company that are doing the other. And they don't have, there is not a self-sufficient team doing a given car.
There
are people who think it ought to be that way, but it's not that way. I hope so. That's the way I'd like to see it go. I'd like to see them shut a door, take 50 guys that are going to design that car, you know, the proper engineers, the designers, the planners, and everything. Lock them in a room somewhere and tell them, do the car. Don't talk to us. Don't ask us anything. Just go do the car. Well, I would hope it would work. I'm sure it'd work. Would it work at the Ford Motor Company? I don't know. Well, we don't know if the GM any better. They're worse than we are. They got a bigger bureaucracy, at least what I can tell, what I can observe. They got bigger troubles than we do. At least we know we're in trouble. They don't even know they're in trouble.
You almost said bureaucracy. Is it easy to become
a That's pretty natural, I think. Isn't that a natural thing for corporations to get old and mature to do? No question. Too many people. Yeah. And too many people. Too many people. Whenever you're working for somebody, the natural thing is to let the decisions go upward because it makes you more comfortable. It makes you sleep better. The hardest thing to do is to make decisions that are above your level, let's say. Because that keeps you awake at night. So the natural thing to do is let all the decisions go up. And they always have. Oh, no question. Not only double duty, double responsibility to a manager, design man, and I absolutely, I have over this new car that I'm going to do almost total control of the design of it. I mean, Jack will be around periodically and say, well, what are you doing, and show me what you're doing, but not like the old days. It's totally different. Jack, first of all, doesn't have time to come and do that. He's got too many other things to do, and he doesn't have time to come and look over your shoulder and tell you how to design the car, so you're responsible. If the Ford Motor Company sinks or swims, it's going to be by the middle-level management people that are making the decisions. Oh, I love it. It's great. I mean, the job I have, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I'd like a little more money and everything, so I want a little more success, but in terms of having an important job or a vital job.
In real sense, you're a person that's in the
field. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What would be a typical...
My group is typical. I have working for me six designers, one of whom is called a design specialist, who is a management level designer, which I was before this time, and then I have five other designers who are basically board designers, sketches, tape drawings, renderings, follow cars, and they execute the work, and I basically manage them, except that in the design profession, maybe this is something we should change. It's hard to change as a manager. I'm a manager who grew up as a designer, not as a manager. I still feel that the basic design is my responsibility and not the designers that work for me. Now, maybe that's wrong. Maybe someday we'll graduate and we're a manager. We'll truly be a manager. And you design the car and I will just manage it. But we're not at that level yet. The design... Design has got to drop to one person. In other words, I said before, seven guys can't design a car very effectively. Somewhere the design has to rest. At the moment, that's probably either the manager or the exec level in a studio, depending on their own personal strengths. Fritz Mangum. Gail Haldeman works. Fritz works for Gail Haldeman, and Gail works for Jack. Once again, Gail is the director of a studio and does not have the time or does not do it either, does not come down and hold your hand at every move. Now, Joe Oris would come down and guide and look at every move on the car. I don't know where he got the time, but what he was doing, it must have been because they did not get into the cost, the engineering, the weight, the problems, the business plans, the profits. All he cared about was the styling. So that's changed dramatically.
So basically, two men are responsible for the key execution.
Yeah, I would say so. And through the Tempo and the Taurus and the other cars I'm talking about are basically we're done at the manager exec level. With the support, let's say, executives. Jack is basically responsible in the sense that he puts the people there and plants the seeds and I guess allows it to happen. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but But the actual hands-on design is done in the studio, manager and exec level. Sometimes a designer, depending on the circumstances. Well, this T-Bird is an interesting one because we talked about all those things I talked about. We said that what are we going to do next and what are the options? And we try to, we're also in an era of time where we don't. There was when I first came to Ford, there was never a written word about the subject of styling. Styling was something you put your tam on and you did it. But now we attempt to write down what it is. We attempt to actually delineate some objectives. What are we after with this T-Bird? We try to do it in words so that we can communicate with each other. And we talk about those objectives and we talk about those alternatives. And we very deliberately mapped out some alternatives right now. We said, here's one way to do the car, and we'll make a model that way. Here's another way. And deliberately we get together and say we're going to do models this way and that way. We don't change once we're starting the model. If the model has a certain philosophy, a certain kind of a car, we try to execute it like that. That's changed too. If that sort of wisdom existed back in the 60s, I wasn't aware of it. It was just a whim. You just did it. It was whimsical. It was at the whim of the moment.
But you're having wide-ranging discussions in terms of how this car.
Sure. Other people have input to it, the company. Marketing people have an input to it. They have a say. They attend the meetings, but they have also, we have had some designer conferences with them where we and the marketing people sit down and say, how do you see the car? You don't necessarily have to go along with how they see the car. They tend to be very pragmatic to what was happening today.
They tend to see the product in terms of market.
Yeah, they also see it in terms of today's market. They're not predictors, let's say. They don't even try to be.
Oh, that's good. They don't attempt to.
Not really, no. No.
Are we going in the right direction?
Right. Yeah, that's what we get paid for, to determine that, though. And that's fun. That's enjoyable. I like that. Yeah, and then on top of that, I just plain like beautiful things too, and that's, you know, and theoretically I'm capable of producing them, and that's why I am where I am.
Well, you've had an interesting succession of areas. Is this the way to go today? What do your younger designers on your staff, what sort of training do they get?
They have every opportunity I had, and more so. I think they're getting opportunities that I had to wait 10 years for. In other words, they're assuming levels of responsibility that I had to work 10 years to get to. So they have every opportunity.
Are they up to it in terms of experience?
No, we're having a little. Are they up to it? The designers are having a little trouble graduating into this new, you know, we say the design profession is changing. It's suddenly become a far more responsible job and not just a superficial sort of a decorative kind of a person. And some adapt well and some don't. A lot of them have trouble, though. That if you don't give a person responsibility for 20 years and all of a sudden tell him tomorrow he's responsible, and you can't change over a lot. So some of them are having some difficulty. No, but I guess that's a question of, I don't know why. Background or something, or affinity for it or something. I don't know why.
You enjoyed the response.
Love it. Love it.
The excitement.
Love it. Yeah, love the unknown. Love to go home at night and have a big, like you're trying to get your car approved the next day and you're really worried about it. You know, you've made some commitments and you've taken some risks and I hate to fail, but so does everybody. But I love that tension of, cars people say that. I hate that. You know, designers are going to. Your batting average is about 300 to 500. Yeah, sure. You can't win all the time.
You mentioned with some enthusiasm or disapproval, the new design approval process. Can you give us a case history of how that came about?
No disapproval. Now, that's, to me, that, how'd it come about? Well, as far as I know, it's a reflection of general corporate America having this introspection of itself and saying, what's wrong and why are the Japanese being able to do what they can do and why can't we? And we hire some consultants, and we've hired a few of those, and they Yeah. Ford Motor Company just got on the bandwagon, I think, or gets on the bandwagon of this, and the consultants, in the case of, I wasn't in on the early DAP process, so I'm not sure whether the consultants instigated how it came about.
Oh yeah.
Outfit called Interaction, at the design center anyway, no, all the way through, an outfit called Interaction Associates. It was a group from San Francisco, the West Coast, who was a specialist in unwinding mature corporations, I guess. And so they've created what, and if I sound skeptical of it, it shouldn't be. I shouldn't be skeptical, although at the moment I'm getting just a bit skeptical of it. I'm almost tiring of it just a bit.
66 months.
Well, it takes us that long to put out a car anyway. It's too long, in my opinion. It's twice, it's 33 months too long, in my opinion, but their philosophy has been that let's see what we are, let's see what we can do, let's not try something, let's not set down a process that's a goal that's unattainable and we'll fail anyway. They're setting down a goal which is simply, which is realistic. That's how long it takes us to do a car. Way too long.
You mentioned the phrase last minute heroic. This is trying to eliminate the crisis.
No, it shortcuts the design approval process by doing what I was talking about earlier when you're in this process which says you're going to start at A and you're going to go to the end, and you've got seven steps along the way. You're on step three, and you've done everything in good faith, but the market changed. And you say, well, let's see, I got to get back to step one, but I still got to bring the car out in time. So we say, well, I'll tell you what, let's compact everything from here on out and go back to step one. So we'll take the seven steps and turn them into this. That's last minute. It's worked. We've done a lot of well. You better believe it, it's worked. I think, as far as I can remember, the Ford Motor Company's always worked that way.
The DAP is sets out to eliminate.
Tries to.
Is it going to be accepted?
I don't know. I don't know whether you could do it or not.
At the moment,
it's a dream, yeah. Well, it's more than a proposal. They have said it will be that way.
Yes,
but we have not executed a 66-month program to prove whether we can do it or not.
Right.
So it's a dream in that. It's unproven. I don't think it's going to happen. I'm worried. I'm a little worried myself.
Worried that it won't happen?
I'm worried that it can't happen. That no, we're going to try. People are giving it a real good faith try. I'm worried that, maybe they'll prove me wrong. I'm worried that we can't make those decisions that far in advance. And we can't live with them. We can't stick with them.
Right.
Well, not necessarily. The market changes so much, though, that oftentimes if we'd have just made up our mind on, decided on something and executed, it'd have been better than to stand around and vacillate and never pull anything on, never do anything right, because you change your mind all the time. So maybe it'll prove me wrong.
Whose idea was this to bring in this consultant?
Don't know. Sue Fry, I think.
Would it have been a
Maybe it's higher than that. I don't know.
It would have been somewhere around that level.
Somewhere around there, yeah.
So, obviously, some